Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Columbus Metropolitan Library welcomes every patron, but beginning in December, visitors will be limited in the number and size of bags they can bring in. Sleeping will be banned, and if a patron must eat, the food must be purchased in the library and consumed only in certain places. That affects access for many library patrons who are also homeless. We're talking about the plight of people who are homeless in Columbus, what the city is doing to address homelessness, and we're starting with the new library policies on packages, sleeping, and food. Joining me is the CEO of the Columbus Metropolitan Library, Pat Lozinski. Welcome back.
Nice to see you, Ann.
I know that this affects all the branches of the library, not just the downtown.
That's right.
Why the policy changes?
Well, clarify a few of those policy changes as well. So the library's had a code of conduct for customers for years and years, and I think most people can appreciate with 6 million visitors a year, we have to have some guidelines for the conduct of our customers. Let's start with food first, because I think that's been a little bit confusing.
I thought it was never allowed in a library.
Well,
have I been missing something out on all these years?
That's right. I'm actually old enough that we had debates on whether or not we would allow coffee. And yeah. Then sort of the Starbucks phenomenon changed all that. Then it was drinks with just lids. And finally, and I'm guessing it's 15 years or more ago, our library decided that it was okay to have food throughout the library. What's happened recently, though, is as people use libraries as third places and they really love the new spaces that we've created, we have situations where people are ordering pizzas and bringing in chicken and the kids are bringing in hamburgers and
gotcha.
Fries. And so this is all about food is still allowed in the library. It doesn't have to be purchased in
okay.
the library either, but it is going to be contained to our meeting rooms, to our cafes and eating areas. And as long as it is still what we would call light snacks and light beverages, that's still allowed anywhere in the library. So if someone—
Like a bag of peanuts.
Someone has a bag of peanuts, someone has a drink with them, that's not the issue. It's really about trying to stay away from the larger meals, if you will.
And as far as when I said purchased, if you can only eat in the cafes and the eating areas, can you bring your own—
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's I think that's where the confusion is. And then contained to meeting rooms, but you must reserve those. So that's for groups that want to get together. And okay.
And then secondly, I would say that we've had the no sleeping policy. That's not a change. So that's something that's been in place for a long time and also applies to all customers. And then the other change that we did make in addition to food is to put a limit on the number of bags or carry-in items that someone would bring. And I think we are at 3 bags, and if my memory serves, a dimension of 32 by 18 by 15.
Which is like what? Bigger than a bread box? You know, what are we talking about there?
We checked with some other libraries and some others who have those dimensions. I know it's larger than the carry-on allowance on an airplane, but
okay.
not a lot larger.
So 3 of those.
Up to 3 bags. And so, and that's just for us, about what we think is a reasonable number to make sure that we have public safety, convenience, and it creates an atmosphere that is conducive to all of our customers in all locations.
We're talking about the library policies regarding food, beverages, and carry-in items. With my guest is Pat Lozinski. He's CEO of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Later on in the program, we're talking about how this affects particularly people who are homeless in Columbus, but we're going to take a broader look at the homelessness situation in Columbus later on in the program. So if you have questions about that, we'll have folks from the city and the Community Shelter Board. What was the trigger? What was the tipping point on all of this?
Well, it was actually in response to situations where we had large numbers of bags that just looked like a really large quantity. And then we had a question of someone leaving their items or having a non-family member watch those items.
While they left the library.
And I think for us, the issue was, well, at some point, it gets to a level of untenableness or unreasonableness for the library as a whole. And I think in response to people said, well, tell me in your policy why I can't do that. And we said, well, we've got a code of conduct with many provisions. Let's just add that provision so that we bring some clarity to the situation. We also and are not putting it in place until December 1 to give people an opportunity to understand it and frankly, to have conversations like we're having today so mm-hmm. that people are aware of the policy.
I know you checked with, as you mentioned, other libraries across the country, also Capitol Crossroads Special Improvement District, and I'm wondering, what did you learn from them?
Well, that it is about creating a policy that is workable for everyone. I think the notion that somehow the food policy was about the homeless. It's actually not the homeless who would be normally ordering the food. I think agreeably in truth of point that it would be more homeless who would have more bags on an ongoing basis. But again, homeless visit all of our locations. We take very seriously the words over the front door that say open to all and try to be very respectful of the homeless community in our locations. This just for us was an important clarification of what our policy would be and a way for us to administer it on a consistent basis.
And so when you checked with airports and the zoo and other venues, homeless obviously don't go to the zoo and the airport. It costs money to do both of those things. But did that have more to do with the other policies?
Actually, I would tell you that we tried to do some local checking on that. But I think we would say that we're most influenced by our peer urban libraries. So I know it was Denver and Sacramento and St. Louis and some others who had recently put similar policies in place. And I think this is an issue that is not just in Columbus.
Of course.
It's everywhere.
At the zoo, for people who have strollers and that kind of a thing, they have kind of corrals. What about people who are homeless, who use, carts and things like that? They're afraid they'll be stolen. Was there any consideration given to that?
Well, I think we all understand that within a policy that specifies three bags and the dimensions of three bags, that's not going to remove human judgment from the situation. And we're going to have to exercise human judgment to make calls in certain instances. On the other hand, I think it's pretty understandable that we're not going to have a corral of some shopping carts or others. That just gets to be a level of work that we're not prepared to provide in the library setting.
How are you going to enforce the new rules? You said human judgment will come into play. Makes sense. But how, different branches have different, issues, strengths and weaknesses when it comes to infrastructure and that kind of a thing.
Well, we have security personnel, I think, in all but two or three of our branches. They're centrally trained. We train our people. And I think for the most part, they're going to make good judgments and good decisions on behalf of our customers, as they have with all the other elements of code of conduct for years and years and years.
Has there been any thought given to having lockers?
Not really, because I think in this day and age, what you begin to fear as well is the security issues around lockers and what's stored there and for what period of time. And could we be inviting something else to happen in the library that would make that difficult for us?
And a
safety issue.
The main library has a part-time social worker on staff. What's her role?
So this is someone from Mary Haven, from their engagement center, and they are there two or three days a week for a couple of hours. And it's really to provide a range of services and counseling and referral to primarily the homeless population. But it would, again, be open to anyone who would be seeking that service. We also have someone who is providing part-time legal service that is on a voluntary basis as well that is happening in our library. And then I think it's the host of other libraries that are of interest to all customers, including the homeless, access to technology, technology training. Those are the kinds of things that we're providing as well in the hopes of addressing our community's needs.
The new library downtown, or the renovated library, the expanded library, how long has it been open now?
So it was June of 16 when it reopened. So
what it was a very new design, lots of changes. What have you learned over that period of time about how it's working? What's working? What's not? Is there anything not working?
Well, I would tell you that what we've learned is how much we always knew this, but it was reinforced and validated how much the people in Columbus love their library system. I cannot walk through that building on a weekly basis to see scores of people who are taking pictures of it. They're just very proud of it. I think what works really well is the open feel that we have throughout, really creating a civic presence that goes beyond the library presence. And that civic presence is the connection to Topiary Park, which is this amazing amenity on the east side of the library that the library's been there with the park for 20 or 25 years. So many people did not know it was there.
You couldn't see it.
We have opened the window to that world. And I think it is it's the space that people really love to congregate. We also have now, we didn't put a theater in, but we have a main reading room that allows us to host major civic events. And even this Friday, we're hosting our own annual fundraiser, the Celebration of Learning, and we'll have 700 guests for a program. And I think people increasingly see the library as the convener for those kinds of activities.
Some of the best views of the city.
I think so.
Yeah.
But I'm biased.
What do you know, just getting back to the issue of homeless patrons, how much do you know, how much information do you have on who they are? Can they have library cards?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, they need a library card in order to have reservations on our computer systems or to check out materials. And they absolutely do. So they are, people say, well, how do you treat the homeless? And our answer is like a customer, because that's really what the public library is all about. And so we understand that they can be very challenged in so many aspects of their life. And let's hope that their library experience is one where they're treated with dignity and support and given the services they need.
There's supposed to be roughly 1,700 homeless men, women, and children in Columbus at any given time. That's about a 21% increase over 2011. So there's been an increase. Have you seen an increase in the number of homeless patrons in the library? Have you noticed anything?
I don't know that we've seen a major increase over what we've had over the last decade or so, but I think the entire community needs to reflect on 1,700 people who are homeless. And on Monday, I happened to be downtown very early in the morning at 5:30, and right on Broad Street, people are homeless and trying to sleep on a very cold morning. And if our issue at the library serves as a catalyst for this community to have more conversations about the homeless, then that's a good outcome of our changing this policy, because that's serious for all of us to think about what's happening.
Pat Lozinski, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time. Have a good gala on the weekend.
Thanks so much, Ann.
Pat Lozinski, CEO of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Coming up, we're going to hear from the city. We're also going to hear from the Community Shelter Board about what sort of strategies are being put in place to deal with the issue of the increasing numbers of homeless in Columbus. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. New restrictions on food and baggage are set to begin in December at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Critics of the rules have said that they will be unfair to patrons who are homeless. We just heard from the CEO of the Columbus Metropolitan Library about why the changes were adopted. He said this is a good, he's okay if that's a catalyst to have a larger conversation about the homeless population in Central Ohio. So that's what we're doing. We're taking a broader look at chronic homelessness in Columbus. Joining us is the Neighborhood and Human Services Coordinator for the City of Columbus Department of Development, Kim Stans. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Ann.
And also Associate Director at the Community Shelter Board, Tom Albanese. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Kim, what do we know about how many people are known to be homeless in Columbus? I used a number, 1,700 men, women, and children. Is that accurate?
Well, I think that's accurate on a given night.
Yeah.
But throughout the year, we see, you know, many more coming through our shelter system.
So I read numbers in excess of 10,000 people.
Correct.
That means there's sort of this churn going on at any given time.
Right. There's a lot of people who are homeless for a short period of time. So they're utilizing our shelter system in order to get back on their feet.
And are there other people that are on and off?
There are some who are like they're in for a while. They find a place and then they become homeless again. But I think we're seeing, we call that a recidivism rate. We have a pretty low recidivism rate.
So once you do find stable housing and get a foothold that way, it usually takes.
Right, and that's the key is finding stable housing.
Tom Albanese, there are different types of homelessness. There's chronic, situational, and cyclical. Mm-hmm. So I think we kind of covered all three of those just now. But let's talk about chronic homelessness, what we mean by that.
Well, chronic homelessness is a very specific experience. It's when somebody experiences more than a year of homelessness and has a disabling condition on top of that. And so we see a relatively small number of people who experience homelessness fall into sort of episodic patterns of homelessness and suffer long-term homelessness. But nonetheless, we do have people in our community who suffer from chronic homelessness that we're doing our best to get housed as quickly as possible.
You know, Matthew Desmond, author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Yeah. It's a well-known book, I'm sure, in your circles. Of course, he's been on the show a couple of times. He supported a universal housing voucher program. Everyone's sort of looking for that. You know, what's the key? But one of the problems with that he demonstrated so well in his book was the not cyclical nature, but how one experience of homelessness can just keep setting you back. And you hear about people who say, well, I got evicted from my last house. Now I can't get credit for my next house. I can't find anybody. I don't have enough money for, you know, the deposits. Housing, there's a housing shortage in general right now in Central Ohio. And we know that housing, homelessness has increased by about 21%. Is that something that's going to go away when we build more housing? Because as far as I can tell, the housing that's getting built is not, it's not affordable for most people that are homeless.
We had Dr. Desmond here earlier in the year to speak with our community about his findings and his study, which was
a groundbreaking
study that he had done, first of its kind.
Yeah.
And I think what he demonstrated was the long spiral downward that families experienced, predominantly African-American, female-headed families. He likened it to a felony. So as you experience an eviction, you're less likely to find a landlord who's going to rent to you, and you just find yourself on this slippery slope down to some more substandard housing. And ultimately, you know, the bottom of that experience is finding yourself in shelter. Of course, we don't want to see that happen for anybody in our community. And there's lots of efforts happening right now to go upstream, to do more work with landlords. The Apartment Association has been a wonderful partner in our community dialogue around how we can stave off evictions and do a better job, because it's really not in anyone's interest to see somebody lose their housing, let alone the landlord who experiences quite a lot of cost. All in all, affordable housing is it is the driving issue behind homelessness. That is the only solution, ultimately, to homelessness, is having more affordable, stable housing available for people with a variety of needs and the right supports to help folks maintain that housing.
Supportive housing is often mentioned as an obvious solution to ending homelessness. What is supportive housing? What does that mean?
Well, I think Tom and I could both talk about that.
Yeah.
But the supportive housing, as Tom was mentioning, when you get someone into housing and that's stable housing, there are people with varieties of needs. So what we're trying to do is bring support around that housing for those folks, whether that's counseling or it's job training or whatever is needed. So that's what – when we talk about supportive housing, we're talking about housing that gets people not only into housing but connected to services.
So it's housing that comes with services. What does that look like? Is it a particular place? Is it somebody who visits you? What does it look like?
Well, we have a variety of things in Columbus. I was just talking to somebody this morning. He lives at Commons at Third, which is a permanent supportive housing that we've done that has a number of units all in one place.
Uh-huh.
And so people who are living there can access different services if they want to. So it's a voluntary thing.
And there's a wide variety, as Kim said, of supportive housing developments in our community. We have close to 3,000 units of supportive housing, 2,200 of which are dedicated for people who experience long-term homelessness, prioritized for that housing. And the services really do vary by project. Some are single site, as Kim described. Some are scattered site around the community where social workers will go to the unit, visit with the tenant, make sure they're doing well, connected to services, are meeting the obligations of their lease, and so forth. So there really is a wide variety. What we find, though, is that we need a full spectrum of housing and support options for people who experience homelessness. Most people who come into homelessness and utilize shelter need just a little bit of support to both find housing, stabilize in it, get connected to services. And really only a small number of folks need the more intensive supports that permanent supportive housing provides them.
I mentioned that there's a 21% plus increase in homelessness since 2011. That's according to data from last year. And do you know where that increase is? Who is it?
Well, I can speak to that.
Sure.
We actually found that in the last number of years since 2010, 2011, there was quite a spike in family homelessness. So we saw large numbers of families coming into the shelter system. The good news is that we've seen actually a slight decline now.
Just in
the past year. I think that we can attribute that to a variety of things.
Job market?
The job market, of course, there's a lot of work happening around prevention. Job and Family Services is trying to do more with their resources to engage and support families. There's really a whole host of things happening. It's hard to pin it on any particular thing. But at the same time, what we're finding is that families are staying nearly twice as long in shelter today than they were just last year.
Is that good?
It's not good because what we find then is we have lower turnover of beds, which means we can serve. It just becomes a stress on the system the longer people stay in shelter. It's really the greatest hardship is on families themselves and, of course, the children who are living in a precarious situation, not really knowing where they're going to land housing-wise. And that's not good for anyone, at least which the families. As we've seen this length of stay in shelter double, what we are seeing at the same time is that families are having a difficult time finding housing, finding a landlord willing to rent to them. The amount of investment that's needed to get into housing, security deposit, first month's rent, last month's rent is huge.
Just beds and pots and pans, right?
All of the above. That's right.
Yeah. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the plight of homeless people in Central Ohio right now. My guests are Tom Albanese. He's Associate Director at the Community Shelter Board. And also with us, Kim Stans, Neighborhood and Human Resources Coordinator for the City of Columbus Department of Development. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Robert in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Ann. I'm calling because of the whole plight of homelessness. Mm-hmm. I'm an individual that goes on and off homelessness. I'm currently right now being housed by SSVS Veterans Program. Mm-hmm. With my situation, I will be bluntly honest. I'm a registered sex offender, and it's hard trying to find housing for registered sex offenders. Mm-hmm. We can't go into shelters. People with arson have the same problem. So it makes it even really more difficult of how to get housing. And then you also got the trying to find a job once you get out of prison, mm-hmm. having this stain on your record. And then JFS, oh, well, you're an able-bodied citizen.
Jobs and Family Services, right.
Yeah, Job and Family Service, you're an able-bodied citizen. We won't give you food stamps unless if you volunteer or work. Can't really volunteer because no HR place will let you volunteer there because of the stain on your record. So it makes it really, really, really hard.
Yeah, this is a recurring topic on a lot of different levels. I mean, we talk about prison recidivism. It's obviously everything that Robert's describing right now contributes to recidivism among inmates. But Kim Stans, I mean, what can you change policy-wise to help people like Robert who wants to get back on his feet and wants to do everything right but is prevented? And it's not just sex offenders. I mean, felons in general have a hard time.
Yeah, that's
ex-felons, I should say.
Right, and that's one of the things that we're seeing is that it's kind of like what we were talking about earlier, that when you start having strikes against you,
yeah,
you know, it's already hard enough if you've been evicted once to get back into housing, let alone that you also have these other strikes against you. I'm not really sure what the policy change would be to do that. I think what we're trying to do is work with landlords and then with those individuals, because one of the things I was thinking about earlier is that every individual who becomes homeless has their own story.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't just say, you know, for these 500 people, this is the answer. It's every person is an individual. And so I think one of the things we're trying to do is back to those services, coming alongside of them and saying, how can we work with you and with property owners and with other service providers to find what you need for you as an individual?
Yeah. What about from where you sit, Tom Albanese, as far as policy changes? I mean, Robert's story is not that unusual. I hear it almost every time we start talking about these issues on the air, and I certainly have heard about it over 35 years of reporting and journalism. I mean, what—
I guess first off, I'd like to thank Robert for his service to our country. He's the veteran. Mm-hmm. He clearly has made some mistakes in his life that he's trying to make up for and has
right.
served his time. I think what we see is that, experiences like that, and not just sex offenses, but other, criminal convictions, they don't go away and they end up being a life sentence, if you will,
right,
where somebody pays for that really for the extent of their life,
right.
whether it's employment or housing or other opportunities that are shut off from them. We feel that people deserve redemption, that if they make a mistake, they make an error, they pay for that mistake, that shouldn't be held against them. And so I think Kim is right. There's not a specific policy change when it comes to people with felonies that we're looking for in sort of with regard to housing. There are certainly things that can be done for employment, the whole movement to ban the box.
Ban the box.
To remove sort of felony as, divulging that as a prerequisite to even be considered for a job.
Mm-hmm.
In housing, however, I think it really comes down to finding landlords who are willing to look past what one's past experience has been and look at the current person, look at the current situation, and lend a hand. We know that landlords have vested interests in their properties. That's their business, their livelihood.
Right.
We care about that. We see landlords as our partners, as our customers, that they have interest. We also know that many folks who own properties, manage properties, rental properties around Columbus are very community minded, are very willing to go the extra mile to help a fellow community member. And we're finding more of those every day, more of those landlords. And that's what we're working on.
You know, Kim Stanz, do you ever feel like you're at cross purposes, though, with the rest of the city government, which is developing, building, all these fancy apartments? They're beautiful. I think they're awesome. Everything's pretty fancy, though, and there is the issue of gentrification in Columbus.
So your first question is, do I feel at cross purposes? I think that the city has policies that say we want to see development happen, but we want to make sure that we're also helping develop affordable housing as well. And so there are a lot of programs that we have at the city to at least help that along, and we're using both city money and federal money to develop more affordable housing.
Like, can you give me an example?
So, like I talked about earlier, like Commons at Third, okay, which is a permanent supportive housing. You know, the city invested some dollars in that. But the apartments that you're talking about are really driven by the private sector.
It's the market. Right.
And so what we need to do is find ways to develop affordable housing through the private market. And you brought up earlier about the universal voucher.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that the vouchers through CMHA, Columbus Metropolitan Housing Authority, and through HUD are shrinking, and we have a big waiting list. So there's really a lot to be thinking about in terms of how do we do that? How do we develop more affordable housing in the midst of our growth?
Mm-hmm. I think the good news is the Affordable Housing Alliance of Central Ohio does have a plan. They've done a deep analysis of the affordable housing needs in Central Ohio, and that, I think, has given new impetus to this question: how can we better support everyone in our community in finding and securing stable housing? And they've identified that we have a significant 50,000 households in our community who need affordable housing. And what we know is that for every renter who's in poverty, for every three renters in poverty, there's only one affordable unit. So we have a significant gap in affordability, mm-hmm, in our community that hopefully everyone is paying attention to.
Is this something that's echoed in other big cities? Is this typical?
It is typical. I think that the housing affordability data is showing that increasingly urban areas and even rural communities are seeing the cost of housing increasing, in some cases, certainly here in Central Ohio, more than double the rate of income. And that's a trend that's not sustainable. Lest we see ever-increasing numbers of families turning to shelter and being pushed out of housing.
We're going to continue our conversation. Obviously, we're talking about the plight of the homeless in Central Ohio and what strategies are afoot to address those issues. My guests, Kim Stanz, he's the Neighborhood and Human Services Coordinator for the City of Columbus Department of Development, and also Tom Albanese, he is Associate Director at the Community Shelter Board. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last year, more than 1,700 men, women, and children struggled with homelessness in Columbus. That was a 21% increase from 2011, and now it's reduced a little bit from then. We're talking about how the city works to address chronic homelessness. Still with us is Neighborhood and Human Services Coordinator for the City of Columbus Department of Development, Kim Stanz, and Associate Director at the Community Shelter Board, Tom Albanese. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What do we know about how Columbus ranks nationally? How does is it typical? I think I asked you sort of in a different way. I asked you that before, but do we know if it's typical for big cities?
Just the terms number of the number of people experiencing homelessness. I in the across the country, I would say Columbus is well ahead of the curve, both in terms of our response to homelessness, how we've organized as a community, which we have been well organized for more than 20 years now. You know, the Shelter Board was founded in 1986. And really in the mid-90s got into gear in terms of organizing a community-wide response to homelessness. So I think in that regard, we're well ahead of the curve. Numbers-wise, we're also doing better than most urban communities. We have a relatively low number of people who experience street homelessness. Fortunately, in our community, we've committed that no family will be on the street for want of a shelter bed. And for half of the year, we're able to guarantee that for single adults as well during inclement weather. We assure that no one is turned away from shelter. Is that good enough? No. We feel we as a community need to do better, and we continue to do better. But really the solution to homelessness is stable, affordable housing and providing the pathways into housing when somebody's experiencing a housing crisis. Even when they might have to use a shelter, so they can quickly exit shelter and not return. And that's what we're always working toward.
Kim Stanz, what's the city's policy when it comes to homeless camps under bridges in vacant areas?
So the city looks at camps. You can look at camps in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. There's an enforcement lens because if they're illegally camped somewhere, that's one lens to look at. But there's also a Housing First lens where we are providing funding through the Shelter Board to Mary Haven to do outreach into the camps. And so there is the Mary Haven Collaborative Outreach Team that goes out and tries to connect people who are in camps to services and to do into housing. So there's really that Housing First lens. Giving people as many opportunities as possible to get connected to housing.
When it comes to enforcement, what's the trigger that makes the city move in and clean up a camp and push people out?
The trigger is usually through our 311 complaint system.
There's been a crime committed or what?
Not usually a crime, but just that they're complaining about what campers are doing or that there's campers on a private or public property.
And how does the city how do they move a camp? How do they address that? How do they just move in? I mean, a lot of people see it in the movies. It looks pretty violent.
Right.
It looks pretty horrible.
Well, our policy is that we want to give people every opportunity as possible before we move a camp to get into housing. Or to at least come into shelter.
So you go to them first and say, we're going to be coming in here in 24 hours?
No, we give them like a couple weeks notice.
Okay.
So we have a team of people who include the Community Shelter Board, Mary Haven Outreach, the city, police, Ohio Department of Transportation.
If it's near a highway?
Right, if it's near a highway. Because one of the things we have to figure out is who owns the land that this camp is on.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's city property, sometimes it's county, sometimes it's the state, sometimes it's private. So we have that team that comes together and then we work together to determine what's the plan for working with this camp.
And, you know, Kim Stanz has mentioned several times Mary Haven. Mm-hmm. That's, of course, reflects the fact that so many people who are homeless are struggling with mental health issues, drug dependency issues, that alcohol and drug dependency, that kind of a thing. And how can you give us a sense, Tom Albanese, how much that does affect the problem of homelessness?
Well, it's a huge factor, and more so increasingly with the opioid epidemic, we're seeing increasing numbers of people struggling with addiction and unfortunately dying in some cases. From overdoses, and it's really a travesty. So as Kim mentioned, we work very closely with the city, with Mary Haven, when it comes to working with folks who are unsheltered. There are times when individuals choose not to come into shelter because they have an active addiction, and we don't lose sight of those folks. We really work hard. Mary Haven and their team is outstanding in engaging folks. The downtown Capitol Crossroads outreach staff are excellent in engaging folks as well in trying to find a solution to their situation. And I have to say that when we work with the city to move a camp or to close a camp, the solution isn't to move that camp to another place to camp. The solution is to give folks real viable housing options, and that's what we seek to do. So as Kim mentioned, we always give folks plenty of notice, and at the same time, outreach staff are there offering access to housing, housing assistance, and the support to secure housing.
Carol in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have two questions. One is, if one does have a property, in our case we have a small, modest two-bedroom home, and might be interested in participating in your program, how would we do that? We've not pursued the HUD or whatever that other program is. I know there's hundreds of people on their waiting list. I talk to them from time to time, and it hardly seems to be functioning very well. But in your case, I think I'm wondering if there's something that we might do to help.
Well,
Tom Albanese?
I really appreciate, Carol, your offer. What I would suggest is please reach out to the Community Shelter Board. We can connect you to one of our partner agencies who might be able to match the housing that you have available to a family or a single adult who would be suitable, a good connection for you. And we have staff across our partner agencies who do this day in and day out. They are out there working with landlords, brokering those placements and making sure it's the right match all around. So thank you so much for that offer.
Yeah, I just want to add to that I think, first, thanks for that offer. And that's one of the things we're really looking for is we know it's not going to be the large companies who are going to be able to solve this. It's going to be a lot of people like Carol who have individual units who are compassionate landlords. But one of the things to let Carol and others know is that the people that we are going to connect with them are going to come with support. So whether that's we're helping people find a job or we're helping people work through the issues that they have so that we're not just sticking people in a house and saying good luck. We really are coming alongside them with a good case management model.
So, Carol, why don't you check out the links on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll make sure that we have contact numbers. Otherwise, it's the Community Shelter Board, as Tom Albanese said, and they can help cook you up with the partner agencies. Thanks for the call, Carol. Susan in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Anne. My question is about evictions. My understanding is that one of the leading causes of homelessness is evictions, and yet there's only one small organization in Columbus that's really focused on mediating with folks so they can avoid eviction. My question is, what is the city and the shelter board doing to help people avoid eviction and therefore avoid homelessness? And I can take my answer off the air.
I guess you're talking about legal aid, right?
Actually, I'm talking about community mediation services.
Okay. So, Kim Stans, what's out there for people who need help?
Well, I think Susan just named community mediation services.
But is it enough?
But that community mediation is really around housing, not so much with the addiction. They're working with people.
No, she was talking about eviction.
Oh, she said eviction.
She said
eviction.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I thought she said addiction.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Community Mediation Services is doing as much as they can with the resources that they have. But there are a number of us working alongside Community Mediation to work on this very thing about eviction. How can we prevent evictions from happening in the future? Tom mentioned this earlier. We're trying to move upstream before someone becomes homeless to try to help them avoid eviction.
Mort in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Mort.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering whether, since we're at an impasse now between all the various answers available, whether any consideration is being given to trying to get funding for basically a dorm room building. Either dorm rooms or very small studio apartments as compared to the cost of an ordinary apartment.
Mm-hmm. What about that kind of housing? And for some people, that's exactly what they need and want.
I agree. Smaller apartments, efficiency apartments,
less burden,
single room occupancy, you know, apartments, shared living housing. We need a whole variety of options. And frankly, we simply don't have enough sort of in at the lower levels of affordability of cost, for people who are single or small families. We have some housing in the downtown area that sort of fits that bill. The YMCA operates some private units downtown, which are a great resource. A lot of folks do leave shelter and go to those units as a stepping stone as they make their way towards more secure housing. We need more of that, certainly.
Email from Lynn asks, and Mort, thanks a lot for that call. Email from Lynn says, what are the most effective ways for the public an individual to donate to the effort to help the homeless?
Well, we would encourage, obviously, contributions to the Shelter Board or any one of our partner agencies. We have 17 partner agencies from the YWCA, the YMCA, Mary Haven, and many that we've mentioned today, all of whom are in our view, doing an excellent job working collaboratively to solve homelessness. What we know is that and the temptation is always, encountering somebody on the street who might be asking for money. It seems to be sort of the surest bet to help somebody who's homeless. And in fact, we know that that's not a great solution. It's not sort of the best use of community resources, if you will.
There are some people selling those newspapers.
Yeah, and that's a great source of income.
Sponsored
by the Columbus Coalition for the Homeless. It's a great opportunity to start to build a resume, if you will, and to start back on an employment path. And many folks do benefit greatly from that.
The other thing is that people can volunteer their own time or their own skills that they bring. It could be through their vocation or just on their own time. There's lots of volunteer opportunities throughout the shelter system and others who are
food pantries.
Food pantries, for instance.
The free lunch, free dinners, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that people want to help and they get inspired by programs like we're having right now but forget then?
I don't know the answer to that, I think there are a lot of people who care about what's going on, and hopefully they don't forget, but they actually take a step to do something.
There is a thing about out of sight, out of mind, too. Pat Leszczynski said, driving down Broad Street early on a Monday morning, you can see it, but a lot of people just don't see it.
I think that in a way is sort of our collective responsibility to keep the issue visible. I mean, we're really thrilled that Pat was on the show today and you're talking about library policy and this intersection of, this great public institution we have with our library, which is just outstanding, and this horrible issue of homelessness and how they come together. I think it speaks to the nature of Columbus and Franklin County and just the spirit here around helping to take care of our neighbors. And so I know for the Shelter Board and our partners, we are constantly trying to keep that out front, that we have a broader obligation.
Tom Albanese, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Tom Albanese. He's Associate Director at the Community Shelter Board. Kim Stans, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Kim Stans is a Neighborhood and Human Services Coordinator for the City of Columbus Department of Development. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.